Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The latest jobs numbers. Can we pay too much attention? Reforming Alabama's tough immigration laws. And job killers, job creators, taking the hype out of the environmental regulation debate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, April 6th. It's good to have you with us. If the stock market had been open today, traders would have been laser-focused on today's jobs report, and it might have been ugly. Sure, the economy added 120,000 jobs in March, but economists were expecting better. Marketplace's Adrian Hill guides us through this latest not-awful but not-terrific news on employment.
It can be easy to freak out about a less than stellar jobs report, but sometimes you got to just take a deep breath and look at how far you've come.
It's still progress.
Gary Bertlis is a labor economist at Brookings.
The pace of job growth has picked up in the last 6 or 7 months, even including a mediocre month such as we had in March.
Last year, the unemployment rate was 8.9%. Today, we're at 8.2%. The economy has added nearly 2 million jobs. But don't get too relaxed on me. We've got a long way to go.
I think we'll probably reach full employment somewhere between 2019 and 2023. And that's no joke.
Sylvia Allegretto is an economist at Berkeley's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. She says the economy is still down about 5 million jobs since the recession, and about 40% of the people who are out of work have been without a job for half a year or more.
It's still much, much higher than we ever saw in any other recession.
The problem, she says, is the longer people are out of a job, the harder it is to get back. Skills fade, jobs change, and some workers are being forced to settle for less. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
So a bright spot in this morning's report on jobs, manufacturing keeps creating them. Since hitting rock bottom in 2009, manufacturing has added nearly 500,000 jobs. But for many of those lucky enough to get back onto the factory floor, wages and benefits are down. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been reporting on the changing blue-collar middle class for our Wealth and Poverty Desk. He met one of these workers in the industrial belt of northwestern Illinois.
Good afternoon, North American Tool.
Scott Silvis is 46, married with two kids. He owns a modest home close to where he works at North American Tool in South Beloit, Illinois. It's a specialty manufacturing plant that makes precision machine parts. Silvis is feeling pretty lucky. Unemployment in this region's over 13%. During the recession, he suffered 2 years of repeated layoffs and unemployment before finally being hired here in 2010.
I was just looking for that one company that would give me a chance, you know, see something in me, and now I'm right back working hard.
For around $17 an hour, $10 less than at his last factory job at GM's huge assembly plant in nearby Janesville. Silvis, a high school graduate, worked there for more than a decade until GM downsized and shut the plant down in 2008.
I consider 2008 and 2009 two of the worst financial years of my life, you know, especially having two children. It was a big shock. I wasn't prepared for it.
Did you lose, you know, house? Were you able to make a mortgage payment?
Or? Luckily, you know, I never bit off too much more than I couldn't chew, you know. I kind of pride myself on paying my bills, but still not being a breadwinner. And, you know, she was making the money at the time. You know, it was traumatic for me as a father.
Then, at the height of the recession, his wife lost her job at the nearby Chrysler plant. All Silvis could find were low-wage jobs, assembling office cubicles, reading utility meters. He got laid off twice more as those companies cut back. Last hired, first fired.
The employers, they could pick and choose. If you weren't really the guy that they were looking for, you were set aside, and a lot of it you had to go through temporary services.
Why didn't you want to do that?
You're not eligible for the same benefits and the same pay packages that the other employees are. So I don't think those are a very good deal for the working class.
Now, Silvis has held on to the steady working class job that he was looking for, full-time with benefits, for going on 2 years. He's slowly building back his savings and his self-esteem. He plans to stay a while. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The stock market was closed today for the Passover Easter holidays, but the bond markets did not take the day off. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It's Friday, and it's time for the weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Here to make sense of it all is our very own New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, and also Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal. They join us from New York. Happy Friday, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Happy Friday.
Thank you. You all heard Adrian and Mitchell at the top of the show. Unemployment's down a little, but job growth was disappointing. Sudeep, I can't decide. What should I be feeling, hopeful or pessimistic?
You can really have them both on Good Friday. We have to be careful. You never want to overreact to a single month's number. We have seen consistent job growth. And there were times during the recovery when we would have been thrilled to have a number like this above 100,000 as a gain. But you also have to recognize that we've seen this horror show over the last 2 years where we'd get the buildup in the early months of the year, and then it just became a deeper and deeper disappointment for the rest of the year. And there's a big fear, and I've been worrying about it for months, that we might be on the verge of that again, because we needed a much stronger recovery to be able to withstand the trouble that we're facing in Europe and with corporate earnings coming up and all the other risks out there with oil. And there's a chance that we may just not quite be there with a strong enough recovery.
Yeah. Heidi, what about the numbers on how long on average people are unemployed? I mean, it's getting to be a really long time.
They're unemployed for a long time, and the number isn't changing. You have over 5 million people who are unemployed, long-term unemployed this year, the same number last year, and the ones who are marginally attached, which means that they've looked for a job in the past 4 weeks, but really they are long-term unemployed, that also hasn't changed, and that's another 2 million people. So, you know, as we heard in Adrian's spot, this is going to be a really long recovery, and the big challenge of it is how do you get those people back in the workforce who haven't been in it now for a year, 2 years, maybe even three or four.
Yeah. Real quick, do you think the Fed is going to be under more pressure to stimulate the economy again?
I think that probably yes. I mean, I'm interested to hear what Sudeep hears in Washington, D.C.
It's really interesting because the Fed has been in this will they or won't they position for a while. Markets are really hoping they will do more. The Fed has kept the door open for a while because they have not really trusted that this recovery has been real and that this was going to be sustainable. And Ben Bernanke has been a skeptic for the last few months against, despite what markets have been thinking, looking for a much stronger recovery. And so he's going to keep this open mind. And you're probably going to see markets swing back and forth where they react to the data. They're going to start betting on Monday that the Fed is going to move toward more easing. And then they're going to pull back at some point if we do get a slightly better number down the road over the coming months.
Yeah. Let's just talk Facebook just for a minute. Word is that Facebook wants to trade on the NASDAQ instead of the New York Stock Exchange. Sudeep, what's so great about the NASDAQ?
Well, the NASDAQ does have some of the big names, Apple, Google. These are the new iconic American companies, the ones that we're all hoping will lead us into a new era as a country built on technology. Of course, it's also like it's 1999. Everyone's looking for the big place to list and grow up and we'll see more talk about bubbles before long.
Right. Now, finally, though, we can't leave this without talking about the CEO of IBM, who, of course, is a woman, and her company is a big sponsor of the Masters at Augusta National Golf Club, an all-male club. So far, they haven't extended her a membership. Will they do it, Heidi?
I don't think that they will. I mean, they've been hemming and hawing all week, and it's a real disappointment.
I think the CEO should just show up with her own green blazer and show them that she's not going to take their kind of antics. And it's great for IBM because they can go out there and show that they've got a woman as CEO who's going to get out there in a controversial situation and stand for what is right and against sexism in a private club. And so it's only going to help them in the long run.
Yeah, a little ironic, though, because this was the day that the White House was celebrating women, right?
Exactly.
Allegedly.
It's sometimes this is the year 2012. It feels like the 1950s when we talk about this story. But we got to wrap it up. Heidi Moore, our New York bureau chief, and Sudeep Reddy of The Wall Street Journal. Have a good weekend, you guys.
You too. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks. Bye.
Alabama has some of the harshest immigration laws in the country, but there is a rewrite underway. Some of the reforms could help out business. Other parts could make life harder for undocumented immigrants. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports on what kind of impact it could all have on Alabama's economy.
The current immigration law in Alabama, known as HB 56, bans undocumented immigrants from working or entering into contracts with the state. Cooper Shattuck is chief legal advisor for Governor Robert Bentley. He says the rewrite will, among other things, clarify the state's law.
The bill, as it's been amended, focuses the efforts on employers and their employees within the state of Alabama doing work.
Shattuck says the governor supports the rewrite. At the same time, he says the original law wasn't so bad for business.
We believe that the economic impact of the original bill has probably been overstated.
Mary Bauer is legal director at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
We have heard over and over and over again from businesses that HB 56 has been a disaster for them.
She says a recent University of Alabama study shows that the state's immigration laws cost Alabama $1 million a day in lost tax revenues, revenue coming from undocumented immigrants, mostly through the state's sales tax. Bauer says in some respects, the new reform bill is even harsher on undocumented immigrants.
They actually added a new provision that requires police officers to inquire about the status of not just the driver, but other passengers in the car, which is a significant expansion and, in our view, a change much for the worse.
Another Alabama bill would repeal the current immigration law altogether. Both state bills are expected to move to committee next week. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
On Monday, commentator Melissa Chadburn argued that paying taxes is a way to value the community you live in. A lot of you agreed with Melissa. Not everybody, though. Tom Daly, who is writing from Chicago, had this to say.
It is easy to see Melissa's point of view. However, as long as we continue to spend far more than we tax, we do not feel the full cost, making these services seem less expensive and less onerous. Will Melissa still feel good when her children receive the bill?
On Wednesday, I interviewed Dr. James Fasulis of the American College of Cardiology about his board's recommendation that doctors perform fewer tests and medical procedures. Kyle Kincaid in San Jose, California, was left wanting more.
I am battling a physician who wants to perform too many tests, but I was struck by the tone of your guest. He essentially said, blame the patient. In most cases, doctors benefit financially from overtesting, so it was not a surprise. Your host tried to confront him, but I was looking for a more spirited rebuttal.
And finally to matzah. Yesterday's interview with Jewish Daily Forward reporter Paul Berger about matzah price wars had several of you writing in with your favorite ways to make matzah more, well, appealing. So we put them to the matzah maven at Marketplace, our New York editor, Jonathan Karp. Claire Berman sent in the winning recipe from Boston, gluten-free matzah toffee bark. Hey, it's got a half a bag of chocolate chips in it, folks. It can't be bad. We'll have the link to that recipe at marketplace.org. That's where you can send us your letters as well. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up...
My name is Cornelius Kammerbeck. I'm a Dutchman who came 12 years ago here in Nice. And my great passion since 30 years has been to become a winemaker.
How this novice saved a dying vineyard. But first, let's do the numbers. A bit of disquiet on a quiet day in global markets. U.S. and major European stock exchanges were closed on Good Friday, but U.S. stock futures traded briefly, and they sank on today's anemic jobs report. S&P 500 futures fell 1.2%, suggesting a weak open Monday when stocks resumed trading. Dow and Nasdaq futures each slipped 0.1%. For the week, the Dow gave back 0.1%, the Nasdaq shed 0.3%, and the S&P 500 had its worst week of the year, falling 0.75%. Bond prices shot up today on signs of a fragile economic recovery. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.06%. And here are some Easter numbers for you. How about 550 pounds and 7 feet tall? That's the size of a chocolate Easter egg delivered to Pope Benedict at the Vatican. He plans to donate it to a juvenile detention center in Rome. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. 35,000 people are expected to join the first family on the South Lawn at the White House for the annual Easter egg roll. The holiday officially continues in some countries with the celebration of Easter Monday. And what baskets are your eggs in? The U.S. stock market reopens Monday after a three-day weekend. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. You hear a lot these days about government regulations as job killers. Well, a new study out of NYU is urging the EPA to consider jobs when it proposes new environmental rules. That literally means factoring in job loss or job creation estimates into the cost-benefit analysis that comes with each of these new regulations. Michael Livermore is the director of the Institute for Policy Integrity at New York University School of Law. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Would you agree that there's been a lot of hype on both the right and the left when it comes to the whole issue of environmental regulation and job creation or job destruction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the hype is the right word, and a lot of hype and hyperbole, really. On the right, obviously, the phrase job-killing regulation has, you know, we did a little analysis where we looked at the number of times that that's shown up in news reports, and it's just grown exponentially over the last 18 months. And on the left, there's this idea that environmental regulation will spur a lot of job creation. And what people on neither side are really thinking about is the net effects. So yes, an environmental regulation might spur some hiring, but also at the same time, it's often associated with some layoffs. And overall, for the economy, a lot of these things are going to wash out. And environmental regulation is just not a big driver of either hiring or layoffs for the economy.
Now, your proposal is to include jobs in the EPA's cost-benefit analysis when they propose new regulations. But I'm wondering, does that really solve anything, given that the EPA is already seen by many people on the right as a left-leaning agency? They may still see the analysis as biased.
There's a problem of trust. Obviously, all EPA can do in that circumstance is use the most sound methodology that they can. I think, on the other hand, what that means then is that the sources that people on the right do trust need to act very responsibly and ensure that they're providing information that's actually also based on the most sound methodology. And that way, they're sending people information, people who trust this information that's actually useful to them.
In the end, though, oftentimes this comes down to balancing out jobs versus public health. We're talking air pollution that, you know, causes asthma, increases cancer risk. Does public health always trump jobs in this sort of cost-benefit analysis when regulators have to make these decisions?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the reality is that it doesn't. What EPA has is this kind of standard methodology where they look at what people are willing to pay to reduce their public health risks, and then they compare that to the cost of the rule. So that's how they balance these things out. The reason they do that in part is because you can't always have public health be the trump, because otherwise you would have regulation that was just far, far too stringent. And everyone would agree that that world of super stringent regulation was worse than the world that we live in, where we accept some degree of mortality risk, but we get other things for it, like being able to drive cars and fly around and have access to, the trappings of the modern world.
In the end, what kind of feedback are you getting to your proposal? Do you think the EPA will start doing what you're proposing?
Obviously, one of the big responses that we've gotten is, look, this is politics. Politicians aren't going to change. And fair enough, that's probably true. But our goal is to really try to affect the broader discourse on this, try to bring the level and the tone down, try to base the numbers at least on some kind of reality. And in the long run, I think that that will have a positive impact.
Michael Livermore is director of the Institute for Policy Integrity at NYU. Professor Livermore, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
If you're sitting down to a Passover Seder or Easter brunch this weekend, what wine will it be? A California Pinot, a French Bordeaux? The south of France, along the Mediterranean, has the Languedoc region for wine. And nestled there in Nice is a vineyard with some, shall we say, strange grape varieties. John Lawrenson traveled there and discovered this story of a winemaker who saved a unique city vineyard from ruin.
Mass at a church in Nice. On the altar, a little surprising this, a bottle of wine. The service is in honour of St. Vincent of Zaragoza, patron saint of winemakers. This martyr was crushed to death in a wine press. Outside, there are over 100 acres of vines, a small miracle given that we're inside the city limits of Nice, France's fifth largest municipality. Its wine-growing district is called the Belle, and grapes have been grown here since the ancient Greeks passed through 2,500 years ago. But at the beginning of this century, this unique vineyard nearly went the same way as St. Vincent.
Cette appellation a failli disparaître.
Ghislaine de Charnassay, who lives and makes wine at the Belle Chateau, says these vineyards narrowly escaped being built over with luxury villas and swimming pools. Galloping urbanization means demand for real estate here is huge. Traditional dancers spin and swirl after the church service as local winemakers uncork a few bottles. Surveying this happy scene, it's hard to imagine the crisis Billy has been through. But a little while ago, one of the local winemakers was caught buying in grapes from another region. Billy almost lost its appellation contrôlée status, which guarantees that a certain wine comes from a certain place. De Charnassay, the grandson of the Baron of Billy, was fighting pretty much on his own to maintain quality and keep winemaking going here. The vineyard was in a hole, but then a stranger with lots of money came along to help it out.
My name is Cornelius Kammerbeek. I'm a Dutchman who came 12 years ago here in Nice. And my great passion since 30 years has been to become a winemaker.
Kammerbeek bought one of the vineyards and the chateau that went with it. In the greenhouses, he found cuttings of two ancient grape varieties that exist only here. They're called Folnoir and Braquet, and wine cellars, caves he calls them, that date back to the Romans.
The vineyards of the Chateau de Crémant were in a bad shape. So my first aim was to restore the vineyards. Secondly, the caves were too small, and after 25 years without any investment, there was a lot of work to do.
Up on the slopes, they prune back the vines at this time of year. From here, you can see the sea and the snowy Alps. There's something special about this place, that combination of soil and climate, local grape variety and know-how that the traditional French winemaker tries to express in his wine.
Good.
These days, there's plenty to celebrate. New winemakers have moved in, most under 45 years old. And that's not all.
Here in Nice, I have to protect all the territory.
Back outside the church, Nice Mayor Christian Estrosi agrees, overgenerously as it turns out, to an interview in English.
For this wine.
Linguistic skills aside, he's done a fine job protecting the Belley vineyards. He turns down all applications for real estate development here. The future of France's city vineyard is at last assured.
And the culture of the wine.
In Nice, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, it could be a little packed in the press box at Angel Stadium tonight. The Orange County Register alone plans to have at least 70 reporters covering the season opener. With stars like Albert Pujols and C.J. Wilson joining the team, the media and fan frenzy is at a fever pitch. The Register's reporters are covering everything from who chose the songs for tonight's game to a profile of a fan who's going to propose to his girlfriend in the stands tonight. The newspaper calls its Angels reporting team the newspaper's first official news mob. We're just happy to hear a newspaper still has enough reporters for a mob of any kind. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. This weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the changing family dynamic when she makes more than he does.
You hate having to ask me for money. And
well, no one wants to feel like they're being a burden or something like that. You don't have to go and say, oh, I need $20 so I can go do this.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Kai will be back on this program next week. If you missed any of today's show or those earlier in the week, check out the Marketplace podcast on iTunes. This is APM.